This is The Full Story at WSHU and WSHU.org. I'm Rebecca Saran in for Ron Ropiak. Today we're checking up on the health of our region. We begin with the opioid crisis. Last week, the Connecticut Department of Public Health released preliminary data that may show the state's opioid crisis is stabilizing. The data track how often emergency departments are used for suspected opioid overdoses. The Department of Public Health says the numbers remain stable for the end of 2018. In September, the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner projected that the number of accidental drug deaths would also remain stable at 1,030. If that number is confirmed, it will be the first time the number of accidental drug deaths did not go up since 2012. Is this evidence that prevention programs are having an impact? Joining us today in the studio is Dr. Bonnie Hopkins. She is the Chief Program and Innovation Officer at Liberation Programs in Norwalk. Dr. Hopkins, welcome to The Full Story today.
Thank you for having me.
Explain to me your interpretation of the data that was released.
Mm-hmm. I was very excited to see the Connecticut Department of Public Health release of the data, and I do think that it's very promising, and we've been waiting many years for signs that the prevention efforts and the other collaborations across the state are taking hold. So it's a very, very promising indicator.
It's good, but it's not great, right? Mm-hmm. As we look at the numbers, we're talking about a difference of maybe 8 individuals. We still, in Connecticut, I guess, the number of overdose emergency department visits is twice the national average.
Mm-hmm. I think that what we're hoping is that it's an early sign that we're turning the curve. And you're right, we're going to have to keep monitoring this and also keeping the pressure on the prevention efforts and also identification and treatment efforts and continue really funding and making sure that we're making that available to everyone across Connecticut.
Let's backtrack a bit. Why are opioids so addictive?
Well, I think that one reason when we're talking about especially prescription opioids is that they're often not used as intended or not used for what the evidence supports that they're most effective for, so that we sometimes have people using them for very long periods and becoming increasingly addicted to them.
Those are the prescription
opioids. For prescription opioids. Mm-hmm. The other thing about long-term use of really any opioids is that they lead to changes in brain chemistry, and you really do have intense cravings and withdrawal symptoms that are very painful when someone stops taking the drugs after a long time.
We were talking a moment ago, and you were citing a disturbing trend, and mm-hmm. that is the use or abuse by women mm-hmm. is higher. Why do you think that is?
I think that we're seeing greater proportions of women than we have in the past. I think to some extent that you can trace some of that back to increasing access to the prescription opioids.
But you say that's changing. Prescription oversight mm-hmm. has been put into place, and you say that's making a difference.
I do think so. I think that in many ways, some of these efforts have been longstanding and tracing back many years. But in Connecticut, we have increasing awareness and use of our prescription drug monitoring program, and that is helping, as well as efforts to just decrease supply and over prescription of these medications.
It's interesting because this epidemic, you know, started with prescription mm-hmm. opioids, but then shifted. And the addictions became in the area of heroin, fentanyl, and illegally prescribed or
obtained.
What are you seeing in liberation programs? Are you seeing this shift to heroin in terms of patients that come to your programs?
One thing that we've seen that's very dramatic over just the last 3 years, and we've been in this field for about 30, is our population has grown by a third in just the last few years, so that many more people have needs in this area and are struggling with misuse of opioids. So we've really had to increase our programs to be able to accommodate the need.
Do you see more in terms of prescription opioid addiction versus addiction to heroin?
I think that we are seeing both, and that very often when someone is misusing one substance, there are other substances that they're misusing also, in addition to alcohol and struggling with mental health challenges as well.
Why do you think there was that shift to heroin and the illegal drugs?
I think to some extent, as you pointed out, there was an awareness that there needed to be safer prescribing. But in the attempt to decrease the overprescribing, then there needed to be, and there still does need to be, more access to medication-assisted treatment to really help people with these, again, very intense cravings, intense with withdrawal, so that they aren't pushed towards other drugs.
Yeah, this has been a somewhat controversial area, hasn't it, in terms of medication-assisted treatment. Explain how this works.
I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of stigma and misunderstanding, and it is really critical, especially for family members who have an individual who's seeking medication-assisted treatment, to become more educated, more familiar. Medication-assisted treatment really means that we have several medications, including methadone and buprenorphine, that can really help an individual not have the intense cravings and not have painful withdrawal symptoms. And in addition to that, the individuals work in other kinds of therapy as well. So at Liberation programs, they have individual counseling, they have different kinds of group therapy, they have family sessions as well. So there's really a range within our outpatient clinics that are part of medication-assisted treatment. But in many ways, it's similar to having a multi-pronged approach for treating diabetes, where you would have insulin, diet, exercise, and also stress management.
And opioid addiction has a very high relapse rate, doesn't it?
And also it very much is still dangerous, as you were mentioning before. Your highest risk of a fatal overdose is actually when you're coming out of an inpatient detox setting, or a detox setting where you have completely detoxed to zero, is the expression. And when you're completely abstinent and don't have something like medication-assisted treatment to support you, you are at twice the risk of having a fatal overdose.
So in other words, in a facility, you're more likely to have an overdose.
Right when you're leaving the facility. If you're not already connected with medication-assisted treatment, you're at great risk of having a relapse and an overdose, because at that point, your body is less tolerant of the drugs that you were taking before. So when you take them, you're more likely to have a fatal overdose.
Let's talk a little bit about the use of Narcan, because this has really helped on the front lines in attacking this epidemic. First of all, explain what Narcan is.
Sure. Narcan is naloxone, and it's available in different forms, but the popular one is a nasal spray that's very easy to administer, and it's truly life-saving, and it's one of the rare times where there's also no harm in giving it if it's not needed. So it truly is able to reverse an overdose, have someone be revived, and then they have time to get to an emergency room and have other care, and truly it is life-saving. And Connecticut and the various state agencies have really been pushing to help make it more accessible, which has been, as you mentioned, truly life-saving. And I do think helping in hopefully stabilizing the overdose rate.
Are you seeing most police departments, some fire departments maybe, but are you seeing more and more communities providing this drug to their first responders?
We are. And one thing that's really wonderful is that we're seeing that first responders, including the police, are really collaborating with agencies like Liberation Programs, collaborating with Beacon Health Options, and really trying to make sure that first responders are equipped with Narcan, but they're also equipped with mental health first aid, or the knowledge of how to connect people to treatment. And that's been a tremendous advance.
Because this is a huge problem. It's not necessarily dual addiction, but it's a dual diagnosis, or maybe lack thereof, that really helps to fuel this epidemic, right?
Absolutely. I would say that There's a term co-occurring substance abuse or misuse and mental health, and very often those go together, and also along with medical issues as well. So really the approach that liberation programs, but also many across Connecticut are pushing, is an integrated care, really addressing the whole person.
How are emergency departments mm-hmm. doing in handling this and assessing those factors pretty quickly, because ERs act fast and they mm-hmm. have to save lives.
And they're just so busy.
And they are.
They are. Well, the Connecticut Hospital Association and the emergency departments across the state have really been putting tremendous efforts in this area, both to help make sure that the doctors are educated, and they are promoting having medication-assisted treatment initiated right in the emergency department, so that someone can start on a few days supply of either methadone or Suboxone, and they can be connected to a treatment facility so that they can continue, as we mentioned before, with really a multi-pronged supportive approach. So the doctors have been very helpful, really critical in that effort.
Yeah, because years ago, they would have treated the patient, sent them home, and it mm-hmm. would have been their responsibility mm-hmm. then to seek treatment.
Mm-hmm. And we really have, across the state, been trying to help address people who are going frequently to the emergency department. And a lot of times it is, one of the reasons is related to opioid misuse.
All right. Joining us today on The Full Story is Dr. Bonnie Hopkins, as we look at the opioid crisis on Long Island and in Connecticut. She's going to stay with us. We're going to continue our conversation, and we're also going to be talking about the flu. It's flu season, everyone. We'll be back with more on The Full Story after a break. And welcome back to The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran, filling in for Ron Ropiak. Today we're talking about the opioid epidemic on Long Island and in Connecticut. To help us do so is Dr. Bonnie Hopkins, the Chief Program and Innovation Officer at Liberation Programs in Norwalk, Connecticut. Before we went to break, Dr. Hopkins, we were talking about the change in treatment in emergency mm-hmm. rooms when patients who have been suspected of an opioid addiction or overdose, the way they're treated. And you were talking about recovery coaches is mm-hmm. also part of this. Explain what they are.
Recovery coaches is, I think, a really powerful intervention. Recovery coaches, training site is CCAR, Connecticut Community for Addiction and Recovery. They train people with lived experience in this area to be able to have a peer-to-peer approach to help other people really navigate the recovery and treatment journey.
Because you said that the recovery from opioid addiction mm-hmm. is really tough.
Really tough. And also, you can imagine there people are fighting against a lot of stigma and a lot of confusion about knowing kind of where to go next. And often people don't have a lot of resources, particularly if they are in a really tight spot and they've burned a lot of bridges. They may be homeless. They may have lost their employment or lost their social supports across the time that they were addicted. And so recovery coaches are really there to be a personal support and focus on really helping them rebuild their lives and again, navigate the treatment journey. And it's really a special program. We're really proud to have just recently hired our own first recovery coach and hoping to hire many more in the year to come. But there's been a lot of support from Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services to fund more recovery coaches, and they're in many of the large emergency rooms. And then you can have a support available, often with a dispatch model, being able to help someone at the point that they are likely suffering the most, but also possibly most open to a different way.
How hard is it for not only the treatment community, but for first responders, the medical community, in heading off and eliminating this epidemic when mm-hmm. the dealers, the cartels, always introduce a more addictive, a more deadly mm-hmm. drug into communities? And I'm thinking of fentanyl. Mm-hmm. And we saw in August, I believe it was, in the New Haven Green, mm-hmm. 100 people had to be treated after K2, which is a synthetic marijuana, had been laced mm-hmm. with the fentanyl. Fentanyl's a big problem, isn't it?
It is. And I think that one of the things that is also very dramatic is the community response after that episode happened, where I think you saw, again, people really coming together to make sure that across different community agencies, people were really making sure that the issues were addressed.
And fentanyl is not that expensive, is it? I mean, that is a big contributing factor.
A big factor of both heroin and then, to your point, even more so for fentanyl. And it is so dangerous. And also to your point that it's not always the drug that someone's even seeking, but sometimes is very inexpensive to be present in other drugs. And then someone is more likely to have an overdose when they're not even kind of aware of what they're taking.
Right. I think those original numbers from the mm-hmm. report we were citing at the very beginning of the program today cited the drugs that were laced with the fentanyl, mm-hmm. I guess, that some individuals who are using don't even know it's in there.
Right. And I do think that does speak to how potentially promising the stabilization of overdoses would be, if especially if we see this trend continuing. But I think that definitely a major takeaway is that the pressing need for help and treatment is really still out there. That this hopefully is an early indicator of success of all those efforts, but that there is still just so much more work to be done.
And Connecticut in particular, why are we seeing the epidemic so hot here?
Mm-hmm. I think that there could be a lot of reasons, and some can even be more awareness of trying to help identify and help those in need. So that one thing in Connecticut is we do have, while we still want to expand it further, we do have access to medication-assisted treatment. We do have access to other kinds of therapies, and I think in some ways we might be more aware of some of the issues than possibly other states that don't have the access to treatment, because sometimes what we know about an issue are related to those seeking care.
So in other words, we're better at reporting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There have been a lot of efforts in Connecticut, including, as you mentioned before, from our medical examiner, who I think is, across the nation, one of the better agencies that's really trying to report all of the deaths that are in any way related to opioids.
And before we say goodbye to you today, what advice do you have for an individual who is seeking help? And I know there's so many barriers. Insurance is a problem. Paying for rehab is a problem. What advice do you have for those individuals?
I think to still let someone know you need help. There is help across Connecticut. Anybody can call 211 and let them know that they need help, and they will be connected to care, and help is out there. And I do think also I would say to all the same thing to all of the family members who are really struggling with this as well, to not give up and to have hope.
It's an up and down journey,
mm-hmm.
right? All right, Dr. Bonnie Hopkins from Liberation Programs in Norwalk, thank you for updating us on what we're seeing with regard to the opioid epidemic, and we do hope those numbers continue to improve, as we just saw in that most recent report. Thank
mm-hmm.
you.
Thank you.
Now, the flu. The flu remains widespread in our region. The New York Health Department has documented more than 43,000 cases of the flu so far this season. In Connecticut, 1,425 patients have been hospitalized with lab-confirmed flu since the season began in August, and there have been 25 reported deaths. Joining me now is Artie Barnes. She is the medical director for infectious diseases at Cornell Scott Hill Health Center. They have 23 centers in New Haven, Derby, Ansonia, and West Haven. Also joining us is Michael Coutieri, a medical director of internal medicine, also from Cornell Scott Hill Health Center. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us. This is Artie Barnes, by the way.
Yes, yes. Well, welcome to the program. Let's talk a little bit about where we are this year with the flu season and how it compares to last year.
Well, I think we are starting to see the peak of the flu season. So at this point, we're seeing more cases than we expect. However, we're way better than we were last year. And I think part of that is we've had a much better success rate with the vaccine this year than we did with a higher match with the circulating virus. So we're hoping that more people get vaccinated as the season progresses, because this time we're really optimistic that the vaccine will do more than it did the last season.
Yeah, Michael, last year was a devastating year for the flu, wasn't it?
Yes, I think it was. I was actually not here for most of the flu season, but from all reports, we had a very high volume of cases. And as Dr. Barnes indicated, the vaccine wasn't exactly a great match. So more illnesses. And a lot of people don't realize this, but even when the vaccine is not completely effective at preventing the flu, it does often make the disease less severe. And we didn't see as much of an effect that with the vaccine in that regard last year either.
In every vaccine, what are there, about four strains? Is that what the CDC typically puts together?
Yeah, I mean, they put together the most common version has four strains. It's called a quadrivalent vaccine, but there's also a trivalent vaccine, and their official position is not to prefer one or the other. Whatever's available and whatever's available as soon as you can get it is preferred, but yeah, we usually have four strains, 2A and 2B strains in each vaccine.
How are people doing when it comes to getting vaccinated for the flu? Are more people getting vaccinated than they have in the past?
Slightly. There was some projections, some very early projections this year that maybe about 6% more people are getting vaccinated. Unfortunately, we're nowhere near our target of 70%. I mean, that's the rate a community needs to be at, the general population needs to be at as far as vaccinations to be able to make a real impact. And most at the nationwide, we're about, you know, between 40 and 50%. And that's about the same rate in both Connecticut and New York. We're only about 40 to 50% in terms of vaccination. Slightly higher rates in children, so we're very happy about that. But there's so much more. I mean, there's so much more we could be doing as far as getting communities vaccinated.
It's interesting, though. There seems to be such a widespread campaign to get your flu vaccine, from what you see on television and you hear on radio and on social media, to free clinics. Companies are offering the flu shot. Is this a number, this 50%, that's going to be hard to break?
By all accounts, it seems that way. There's a widespread perception that the vaccine actually causes illness among patients. And to some extent, we're a victim of our own success, because we're, put it more accurately, we're a victim of the flu virus not being as consistently deadly as it had been in the past. People tend to think of the flu as a mild or uncomfortable or slightly prolonged cold, whereas people who actually get influenza realize that it can be 1 to 2 weeks of very severe illness, can lead to hospitalization and death.
Well, when you look at the numbers from last year, I think the numbers show 80,000 people in the United States died last year from the flu.
Right, and I think that number should be publicized a lot more than it actually is. People tend not to be as aware of it as, say, other epidemics in the U.S.
Which population is the most vulnerable to flu?
That children are, and pregnant women, older people, people above the age of 65. And unfortunately, children are the most vulnerable, because when they tend to get the flu, they're more likely to get severe infections, severe respiratory infections, and get admitted and even die from it. And so the other group that is not as prevalent but are very vulnerable to it are people who are immunocompromised, as in their immune systems are not working at full speed. They're not able to protect themselves from all the infections out there, and they become very vulnerable to complications from the flu. Another group in terms of, you know, people who have complications are those who have respiratory conditions like COPD or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, people who have really severe asthma, people who have multiple sclerosis or problems with, you know, moving the secretions from their lungs. And even people can be vulnerable from very poorly controlled diabetes. Those are the groups that should be protected as much as they can be from the flu.
You mentioned children as a vulnerable population. Let's talk about when a child should be vaccinated for the flu. How old do they need to be?
6 months. Okay. Very young. And I think that's why there's an emphasis on getting pregnant women vaccinated too, because those first 6 months of their lives, they actually get protection from their mother's vaccine. It's called maternal antibodies. So that's why we want pregnant women to get vaccinated so that the babies get some protection from their mother till they're old enough, as in 6 months old, and they can be vaccinated themselves.
And it's safe for a pregnant woman to be vaccinated for the flu?
Absolutely. The only vaccine that, you know, we want to use with caution is the live vaccine, which actually has the live virus, and that's the spray. The common standard routine vaccine that we all get is not the live vaccine. So it's the inactivated vaccine, the one that the shot that you get in the arm.
How effective have the antivirals like Tamiflu been in treating flu, Michael?
Well, I'll let Dr. Barnes answer that. She's very good with that data.
It's actually about, you know, it can be about 60% effective. So it's really not that as not much more effective than the vaccine. And a lot of people rely psychologically on the thought that they'll just take the Tamiflu instead of getting the vaccine. And you have to take it early, within about 48 hours of even having symptoms. And you, by then, unfortunately, from a public health standpoint, you may have already spread the flu to others. And once it is active, it you still could, even though you're protected to some extent from the from having severe complications from the flu, you could still spread it for about 7 days after taking Tamiflu. So while it might do you some good as a and as an individual, but as a member of the community, I think getting vaccinated is so much better.
And there are oral, I guess, well, let's see, there's a nasal, is it a vaccine that you can get as well as the injectable? There's different kinds of treatment. Explain to us what's available to patients today.
So the two types of vaccines, just the live vaccine and these inactivated or the killed vaccine. And then from the live vaccine is used in special circumstances. I don't know if people still remember the 2009 epidemic when it was really severe swine flu and almost all of us were getting the live vaccine then. That's the squirt up the nose. And the inactivated, the killed vaccines are all injectable. And you have the standard dose in that and you have the high dose. And the high dose has some benefit for people who don't respond as well to the standard dose, and those are the our elderly group of people above the age of 65. And I don't, you know, want to complicate things further, but there are even what I hear a lot from patients are concerns about egg allergies, and some of the killed vaccines are made in from eggs, and the others are actually made from cell cultures. So people get confused about which vaccine to take, but the CDC is pretty clear. It doesn't really matter. Even if you have an egg allergy, the amount of egg protein in the vaccine is so negligible as to not really be a concern. So a big challenge with getting people vaccinated and trying to figure out which vaccine is all the mythology and all the concerns and about what vaccine will work or not, but the big goal is to just keep it simple, demystify the process, get the standard shot of the, you know, the inactivated vaccine as early as you can in the flu season.
And is it too late to get the flu shot for this flu season?
No, not at all. People should very eagerly go and get their vaccine if they have not gotten it already.
And how long before you develop an immunity to the flu after you've gotten the vaccine?
About 2 weeks.
Okay, and then the flu season, when does it come to a close?
That often depends on the year, and it's difficult to predict when it's going to close. We had an extended year season last year. I'm not sure that anybody can give you a reliable indicator. All we can say is that the cases are nearing, as Dr. Barnes said earlier, somewhat of a peaking nature. So maybe around May would be the end of the season.
And reinforcing the message of washing your hands, coughing into your arm, would you like to reinforce that for us, Dr. Barnes, to our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, we're all part of a bigger world, a bigger village here. We need to protect each other as much as we do ourselves. And if you sense that you have, you're coming down with the flu, please, you know, wear a mask. If you wear one of those little masks, if you can get hold of those. But if you are in public spaces, always wash your hands.
Okay.
Before you touch surfaces, before an athlete touch surfaces.
Great advice. Dr. Artie Barnes, Michael Gutierre, both from the Cornell Scott Hill Health Center in Connecticut. And we'll be back with more on The Full Story. Health officials in New York and Connecticut are on alert for the measles. This month, Connecticut has identified two adults with the disease. New York is experiencing one of the most severe outbreaks of the measles in decades. 182 cases have been confirmed since the fall. Health officials responded by working to bring up vaccination rates to stop the spread of the disease. The effort has had an impact, but certain groups are resistant to vaccinating their children. With me now are two guests who are working to educate communities on the importance of vaccinations. Melody Butler is a nurse at Good Samaritan Hospital Medical Center in West Islip, Long Island. She is also the founder and executive director of Nurses Who Vaccinate. Also joining us is Dr. Aaron Glatt. He's chair of the Department of Medicine at South Nassau Communities Hospital. He is also the spokesperson for the Infectious Disease Society of America. Welcome both of you to The Full Story today.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure for us to be here.
Dr. Glatt, I'd like to start with you before we get into some of the research that's being done. We haven't seen widespread measles since the 1950s, and we've got an entire generation that really doesn't know much about the disease. Can you just give us a summation of what measles is and how dangerous it is?
Sure. Measles, people have to be reminded, it is a fatal disease, has been, and it still is. There are hundreds of people dying this year alone in Europe, and unfortunately, there are outbreaks all over the world, bringing measles back into the forefront, even in places where it's essentially been eliminated. Measles is a fatal disease in between 1 in 500 and 1 in 1,000 people who get it. So that's something that we must all remind ourselves of. This is not a benign flu, mild, cold-like illness. And I suggest that flu is not a fatal illness as well, but people can't think of this as, oh, it's a mild childhood illness that they will get over. It is a potentially fatal disease, even in children that don't die from it, thank God. Unfortunately, it can have very severe consequences and sequelae, which means complications of the disease, both in terms of neurological and muscular and other complications. So this is a very serious disease, which is essentially 100% preventable with appropriate vaccination. Vaccination is very simple. It is very safe. It has been around for years. It is absolutely not related to autism, zero. Clearly studies a lot of misinformation about it. And this is an essential childhood vaccination that every child should get. If every child was vaccinated, there would be zero measles outbreaks right now. We've eradicated smallpox. We've come close to eradicating polio. We should be able to eradicate measles.
Before we get into the vaccinations, measles not only is a deadly disease, but it's highly contagious, isn't it?
Absolutely. You could be in a room with somebody that had measles that was in the room an hour or two before and still acquire it. If you were exposed to measles and you've not been vaccinated, you will almost certainly get measles. Even if you've been vaccinated, the vaccine is a great vaccine. It's a safe and effective vaccine, but it's only about 98% effective. That means if 100 kids are in that school or in that area where a person with measles is present, even if you had 100% vaccination, you'd still get some cases of measles. But without vaccination, you're going to get almost everybody in that room to unfortunately acquire measles, and then they can spread it. And that's the concept of herd immunity. Even if you have a few cases in vaccinated patients getting measles, that won't spread so much because most people won't be at risk. And when you have, unfortunately, a lot of people gathered together and they're not vaccinated, that's the unfortunate way that we do have outbreaks today, and we have seen some extremely serious outbreaks in all parts of the United States. It's rampant in Europe right now. It's rampant in other parts of the world, and this is unfortunate because it's preventable.
Yeah, Melody, you started Nurses Who Vaccinate, a movement to get kids vaccinated. Tell us about why you started your organization.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I started my organization after I found out that there were so many prominent anti-vaccine websites and Facebook books popping up. I have pediatric nursing experience, and I've worked med-surg for adults, and now I'm an infection preventionist. And I come in contact with people who are always so hesitant and afraid of vaccines. So when I was coming across this same misinformation online, I was appalled that none of these individuals who are hosting these websites or groups were being held accountable for the dangerous misinformation they were putting out there. So when they were not receptive to my me bringing forward why their information was inaccurate and correct, I started my own page, and from there it started, we turned into a nonprofit organization because there's such a need for nurses and healthcare professionals to gather together to collaborate and plan on how to prevent vaccine-preventable diseases and how to really communicate with society and our patients with the best ways. We're always coming up with new plans and you know, looking into evidence-based research into the best communication styles.
And you, nurses are really the first healthcare worker to work with the patients. The doctor comes in later, so you probably hear from the moms and dads right away.
Absolutely. And sometimes a nurse can be the one who makes or breaks whether a patient's going to get vaccinated. And it's so important that nurses are trained and they're educated on the importance of vaccines and how safe and effective they are. There's so many resources out there. Unfortunately, you know, a full-time working nurse, we don't always have time to look into what past what we have to do for work. And there's all this information out there. So what Nurses Vaccinate does is we gather all the webinars, ongoing conferences, and we make sure that it's available to the frontline nurses so they can easily access it and then share the information that they get to their patients. There's so many great resources out there and so many organizations that we partner with to help get the message out. We work with Voices for Vaccines, which is an organization that helps educate parents to become vaccine advocates. We work with Shot at Life, which helps to campaign to bring vaccines to children overseas. And we work with Average Holiday 2, Vaccinate Your Family, another domestic American-based organization, nonprofit organization that helps to educate. There's so many different organizations out there that are really working hard, and we're really trying to bring all the great work they're doing to the frontline staff and then to the patients, because that's where it's happening. That's where the decision-making is going to occur. It's going to occur after the doctor comes in and makes his recommendations, and then as nurses, as well-educated nurses, we need to reinforce how important that is.
Yeah, Doctor, this misinformation that got into the community about the connection between the MMR vaccine and autism, this goes back to the 1990s, and really, was it just one doctor who filed this report?
So I wouldn't say it's one doctor, because that doctor lost his medical license.
So one man, really.
It's a person who published material in a prestigious journal, which unfortunately was retracted by all of his co-authors because of misleading, incorrect, and just simply outright fraudulent work. That is the only paper that has ever even suggested. It was only in 12 or 13 patients, and it was unfortunately retracted because it was fraudulent, and there is no paper anywhere else suggesting such a link. And in fact, there are 30 published papers in top-notch journals totally disproving, not just, you know, I think it's not, but 100% guaranteed, as anything in science can be guaranteed, zero relationship between the MMR and autism, which, by the way, the MMR vaccine was around for about 25 years before autism spiked in this country. And I feel terrible for patients or parents who have a child with autism. It's a very, very difficult diagnosis, and my heart goes out to them. But that doesn't mean that it's due to vaccination, and that because a child, unfortunately, was vaccinated and then gets autism, there is no scientific connection. And unfortunately, there are people out there that are still giving out that misinformation and creating new misinformation. misinformation about any potential link between autism and MMR. There simply is no, zero, absolute link between the two. And unfortunately, we can't get that information across to people because there's so much misinformation and so much irresponsibility being put on the internet, and people don't recognize the difference between something published in the New England Journal of Medicine and something that's on a website on the internet.
I know that you're involved with the Truth in Medicine poll that's conducted by South Nassau Communities Hospital. Tell us a little bit about the poll, what you're looking to gather from that information, and what are some of the results that you're seeing?
So South Nassau Communities Hospital does on a quarterly basis very important public health polls to gauge what the public is thinking about certain areas in medicine. We just did one, for example, on HPV vaccination. We've done one on flu vaccination. We've done others on many cutting health, public health important subjects to try and figure out where there is lack of appropriate scientific education and information out there, and what we can do as a tertiary medical center to try and combat that misinformation. And these polls have been very, very well received. They provide us with a lot of very useful public health information, and then we can go and try to correct the misconceptions that people have. So one of the things we can try to correct through this is to show people how safe and good vaccinations in general are. Now, I'm not an advocate for every person getting every vaccine, but appropriate, judicious, proper medical usage of vaccines is the single most important life-saving technology that medicine has ever produced. We no longer have one disease in this world. The only disease we've eradicated is smallpox. 300 million people died in the 1900s of smallpox. Nobody dies anymore of smallpox. That's only due to vaccination. A similar story with polio, and we had a similar story with many of the other childhood illnesses like measles. And yet, because of misinformation, well-intentioned people in general, some real people using this financial advantage for themselves. But in general, the parents that don't want to get vaccinated, they truly believe that it's dangerous, and we need to educate them that it's not, and that they're actually hurting their children by not vaccinating. And they're certainly hurting the children that can't get vaccinated. If a child has a medical contraindication, they have, unfortunately, cancer, they can't get certain vaccines. When those children are exposed, it's literally a life-threatening opportunity for them to be over their cancer and now, heaven forbid, die from a vaccine-preventable disease. So this is really a very, very sad situation. And everybody needs to understand that even if you make a personal decision for yourself, you're impacting many, many others by it. And if it's done for the wrong reason, a lack of information or a misconception that's been scientifically proven to be incorrect. So then we need to keep these children out of school. They need to, the departments of health have the right, and they have done this. They've not allowed unvaccinated children into school. We have to remove some of the ways that, unfortunately, unvaccinated children can cause widespread disease in this country because they come into contact with children that can't get vaccinated or children that have been vaccinated but now are getting exposed to diseases and getting sick from them.
I know, Melody, you wrote an op-ed, and first of all, why did you feel so strongly that you needed to write this op-ed? And tell us a little bit about some of the key points you included.
So I wrote the op-ed because I feel us nurses, we have such a platform that we need to be utilizing it for more public health education. And what better way to get the message out there was to write to my local newspaper. So I wrote the op-ed, and I feel really strongly about this because I know that parents are reading it and they're looking for guidance. And we see this all the time. They are looking for information, and I'm not interested in trying to convert the heavily, anti-vaccine organizations. There are some people I'm never going to convince, never going to be able to educate. I'm focusing on the parents who, meanwhile, just came across some scary-looking website, and now they're hesitant. Now they're afraid, and rightfully so. Some of these websites have really sad, scary stories on them. But what's so important to remember is that none of it has been verified. It's not true. It's not validated. And it's not validated by the research that's being conducted around the world. So So when I wrote the op-ed, I wanted to make sure people know how strongly majority of nurses and doctors feel about vaccines, and it's that we use them. I have 4 children of my own. I can guarantee you we are up to date with vaccines. I myself, as a registered nurse, I get everything I'm supposed to. My children are up to date, and we speak to our family and friends. We're walking the walk that we're talking. My kids are also vaccine advocates. They tell their friends, look, I got the flu shot. When are you getting yours? So writing the op-ed was just one example of the vaccine advocacy that nurses and vaccine advocates can take part in. There's so many different ways people can do this. I mean, I've even hosted community events. We've hosted Q&A sessions for new parents, because that's when you're pregnant. It's one of the best times to really look into the vaccine issue and find out properly vetted information. So we've hosted seminars for vaccine parents. We do live chat sessions. A lot of my advocacy, though, I will say, comes from social media, because majority of the time, where are parents and people going, you know, when they have questions about vaccines? They're not calling up their doctors. They're not calling up their nurses. They're going on Google, and they're going to type stuff in. So it's so important now that we work together with all these social media websites to make sure that the information being put out there that's on the forefront is evidence-based, well-researched, pro-science information, because that's how people are going to be basing their information on. I want to make sure that parents, they get that right information, and instead of encountering the misinformation, so I'm not constantly doing damage control. I mean, sometimes that's unfortunately what ends up happening. People come across scary stories, just like you mentioned the HPV vaccine, which is a tremendous achievement we have. Australia has been able to almost eradicate HPV because they went ahead and mandated HPV vaccines for their students. Unfortunately, we have not followed our partners down in, you know, down under. I wish we can one day. We can really promote the HPV vaccine for all that it's worth. If people really understood how effective that vaccine was, people would be lining around the street online waiting to get their vaccine for their kids. It is such an amazing, safe, and effective vaccine.
And Dr. Glatt, could this just be the beginning if this anti-vaccine, you know, thinking continues? Because we really that vaccine is measles, mumps, rubella, which is German measles. We really haven't seen a resurgence of the mumps and rubella, have we? But
We have seen multiple resurgences of the mumps. Had multiple, but in our own backyard in Long Beach last year, in other places in the New York metropolitan area, we've seen multiple mumps outbreaks again. Now, mumps is not as fatal, potentially, a disease as measles. That's not a good argument that we shouldn't concentrate on eradicating a disease that can cause painful complications and just cause illness in children when there's no need for them to get these illnesses. We need to, as a society, decide that we want to base our public health upon hard, evidence-based medicine and not based upon anecdotal, impossible-to-disprove, personal, one-time experiences, which is exactly what you find on the Internet. People with very sad stories and with very compelling ways of telling it, but it's scientific, and it therefore can't guide us in how we practice medicine. Doctors go to school for a long time. Nurses go to school for a long time to understand this. It's not something that you can just say, I can read an article on Google and now be able to argue with a senior infectious disease physician as to whether or not something is true. The field is too complex sometimes to explain the real nitty-gritty of a study. Patients don't even have access to the full studies. Most of the real studies are behind journals that charge a fee for them, and physicians pay these fees and read the articles and get the articles. You can't get the full article. You may at best get an abstract. You may at best get a snippet of information from somebody else who claims to have read the article. And that's the misinformation that's out there, and it's so convincing.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Glatt. Sorry to cut you off, but you've been so helpful in sharing your information, as well as Melody Butler. We'll be back with more tomorrow on The Full Story.